name is Leah Carter. I'm a medical student, abortion and loss doula, and health policy advocate working towards health equity and access to underserved communities.
And my name is Brianna Lopez. I'm a winemaker, current master's student, and advocate for raising awareness about exploited women, specifically human trafficking.
You are listening to ACT UP, a podcast that addresses important issues in our world today. Join us as we discuss hot topics, influential women, and grassroots movements across the country. We raise our voices to not only boost awareness, but to spark our listeners to take action within their communities.
The time of this recording is Sunday, October 19th, 2020 at 9:48 p.m. Things may have changed by the time that you hear this. Before we dive into hot topics, we would like to put a content warning on this episode due to talks of murder and police brutality. Our first hot topic is about French police and how they are conducting raids against suspected extremists after teachers' beheading. Police in France raided numerous homes today in a sweep of suspects alleged to have offered online support for last week's beheading of a school teacher who had shown his students controversial cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The Interior Ministry said, the raids come as thousands have poured into the streets in France to show solidarity in the wake of Friday's attack in northwest of Paris, where history teacher Samuel Paty, 47, was killed by a man later identified as an 18-year-old who was born in Moscow. Earlier this month, Paty showed his students the cartoons as part of a civics lesson on freedom of expression related to an ongoing trial over the 2015 attack on the Paris offices of the sacrificial magazine Charlie Hebdo. The magazine had been targeted for publishing the cartoons. Depictions of Muhammad are seen as blasphemous to many Muslims. According to police, the attacker cut Paty's throat and decapitated him, then posted a graphic claim of responsibility on social media. In a confrontation later, police fatally shot the attacker. Interior Ministry said that the raids were aimed at sending a message that enemies of the Republic would not be given the time of day. French authorities said 15 people had been detained and that 51 Islamic organizations in France were also being investigated. One of the people arrested was a father of a student at the school who's an Islamic activist.
I had no idea that any pictorial depictions of Muhammad were seen as blasphemous in Islamic communities. So that was something new that I learned. But it's also interesting to me that they're singling out Islamic organizations for, at least from the surface and what you've discussed, it seems like it's the acts of a lone wolf. Like,
yeah,
did anybody who is a lone wolf, like, might have been radicalized by certain things, like in their upbringing or in engagements that they have with other people. But I mean, we don't know enough, but to me, it doesn't seem like this was something that was planned by several Islamic organizations to behead this teacher. This is so tragic, though. Like, all of these students now lost their, like, 2020 is terrible, but now they have this this trauma that they have to deal with. And it was unexpected, and it was very violent.
Super violent. When I had just read this today, because it literally, the raid happened today, but the incident happened Friday. And I've been hearing for the last, like, couple months about this cartoon. I've never looked it up, but the trial for the 2015 attack on Paris was just recent, had just been recently conducted. So when I read this, it definitely brought back all those articles and podcasts that I was listening to that brought that up. But the also thing with this, with the whole freedom of speech, a lot of people, like, so thousands of people gathered because they're in support of this freedom of speech, that technically no one should be beheaded just because, you know, you create a cartoon or you talk about maybe a controversial topic. But this teacher is a teacher in all aspects. He was showing his students this cartoon and expressing how this is freedom of speech. He was simply doing his job. He wasn't making fun of or getting angry at the cartoon. He was simply, in an educated manner, showing this to his students. So for someone to go and take it to such extreme measures to go and behead this teacher for showing it in a classroom, I think it's just like ridiculous.
Yeah. And it's also interesting. It just kind of brings to the forefront of my mind the different liberties that may or may not be taken for granted in different parts of the world.
That's very true. But I'm pretty sure in France that they have freedom of speech, obviously, from this cartoon. But just because one person, or even, let's say, a religious organization, believes that there shouldn't be freedom of speech, doesn't mean you should go and be murdering people, beheading them.
Yeah, that shouldn't be the consequence. I agree.
There's lots of things I read that I don't agree with, but I don't go beheading people because I don't agree with them.
This is really sad. I really hope that this teacher's family finds peace. Did it say what age the students were?
No, and that's what I was just thinking. No, it didn't say the age of the teacher or the teacher's students, but the teacher is, you know, still pretty young, 47. But yeah, I know that even when I was in school, it doesn't matter the grade, elementary, middle school, high school, undergrad, I was always close to my teachers. To have lost one, I can't even imagine, especially to like something as extreme as a beheading. It's not just like, oh, they died of a heart attack or natural causes. Like, this teacher was murdered.
Yeah.
And that's just a whole new dimension.
Mm-hmm. I might be reading too much into it, but the fact that they said school teacher and not professor makes me think it's like
either elementary,
maybe up to high school. I feel like sometimes teachers are called school teachers, but then again, I could be reading into it.
I agree. I think it's probably definitely in the elementary, middle school, high school kind of age range for students, not necessarily professor, because usually even in other countries, they have terms for like what we have as professor.
Mm-hmm. Nigerian youth take to the streets to protest police brutality. Some people may have noticed NSARS trending on various social media platforms, but it has nothing to do with any pandemic virus. SARS is an acronym for the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, a militarized law enforcement group in Nigeria that was started in 1985 by Kulani Kwajafa with the intention to curb robbery throughout Nigeria. SARS is now notorious for police brutality, corruption, and extrajudicial murder. And SARS protests began in Nigeria after SARS forces murdered a young Nigerian man, left him for dead on the side of the road, and took the Lexus that he was suspected of stealing. There are many stories of SARS officers targeting Nigerian youth found to have anything new or of value, items ranging from new cars to iPhones to certain brands of clothing. There have been many calls to abolish SARS, and the government in Nigeria has responded saying that they will disband SARS and replace it with the SWAT team. Your face is exactly how I reacted when I was just like, that's not better.
I know.
The founder of SARS, Kwajafa, he rejects the substitution and he rightfully fears that any changes made will be undermined until there's a change in the mentality of the officers and the government officials towards citizens. And something that I found really interesting when I was investigating more about this is you have this SARS special force, right? And they're trying to, literally it's in the name, they're an anti-robbery task force, although now they're riddled with corruption and they harass people and then they'll leave them alone if they receive items of large monetary value. But then on the other hand, you have half the country of Nigeria struggling with hunger this year. A report from August estimated that about 85% of Nigerian households are currently facing moderate to severe food insecurity since the Nigerian President Buhari closed the borders to regulate the smuggling of rice.
Smuggling of rice?
Yeah, so on one hand, you have this force who is targeting people with a lot of money and flashy goods or whatever they deem flashy goods. And then on the other hand, you have most of the country smuggling rice to feed their families.
Can you not get rice in Nigeria? They either smuggle it in?
You can, but I don't think that the amount that they produce is enough to feed all of the people there. And it seems like the cost of rice has really skyrocketed, especially since the pandemic has hit different parts of it. And I know that that's impacting labor and agriculture and everything else. So.
Yeah. Wow.
One thing that I did appreciate was that it was the, you know, the young people who were leading the protest, because Gen Z, they're just fed up. They're just like, no, we're not going to do like the millennials and just complain and have five dogs. We are going to take to the streets and
five dogs.
And we're going to let you know that we've had enough.
It's really hard on these organizations. And this is just like the story of many organizations. They start out with a well-rooted cause of activism to make a genuine change. But somehow along the line, whether it's people they get involved with or people in the organization that change, but somehow it gets manipulated and the original purpose is no longer there. Mm-hmm. And saying that, like, for example, the SARS, like having to receive items of value, iPhones or clothes or clothing, like, that's ridiculous.
I mean, it's also really telling that the person who founded this special group recognizes how far the intentions and the actions of the group have strayed from his original intention. He just wanted robbery to stop. You know, it's a very noble concept.
Yeah. But
so far from that right now, he even is just like, no, anything but this. Like, I know this is my baby and I created it, but we need to.
It's not what he created it for.
Exactly.
Our next talk topic is about how in Tulsa, there's a search for victims of the 1921 race massacre. Evacuation crews are breaking ground in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in an effort to find the remains of Black victims of one of the nation's bloodiest race massacres. This will be the second such excavation led by the city this year, as it tries to determine where the estimated 150 to 300 victims of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre were buried. Historians say white mobs targeted the area of the city known as Black Wall Street, killing Black residents and looting and burning businesses, homes, and the churches to the ground. In the latest search, Tulsa is focused on two areas of the city-owned Oak Lawn Cemetery. The first is called the Original 18 site. Funeral home records and other documents for the 1921 show that at least 18 identified and unidentified African American massacre victims were buried in the city-owned cemetery, according to an announcement by Tulsa City officials. The Original 18 site is located near two race massacre headstones in the historically African-American area of the Potter Field section. The second location is called the Clyde Eddy site, named after a 10-year-old boy who historians say witnessed victims being buried there 99 years ago. A core sampling and positive test evacuation will simultaneously take place at the Clyde Eddy site, also located in the southwest section of the cemetery. The evacuation is expected to last about a week. City officials in July moved forward with an initial test evacuation in Sexton area. Also in the Oak Lawn Cemetery, hopes were high after scientists previously reported they found anomalies in the cemetery that could indicate the existence of an unmarked burial ground. However, after 8 days of searching, the city announced it found no evidence of human remains are present in the evacuation area, according to a statement. A group of Oklahomans filed a lawsuit in September against the city and other local entities calling for reparations, including a 105-year-old woman named Leslie Benningfield Randall, who survived the massacre. There was no specific damage amount sought in the filing court, but the lawsuit estimated that just the property damage to residents of the Greenwood District is between $50 million and $100 million in today's currency. A commission that studied the events, which took place between May 31st and June 1st in 1921, found it was most likely triggered by an incident in an elevator. It determined that a Black man named Dick Rowland likely accidentally stepped on the foot of a white woman, Sarah Page, who screamed. Rowland fled, according to the 2001 report, but was later accused of sexual assault and eventually jailed. White mobs gathered outside the Tulsa County Courthouse, demanding Rowland be released to them. The massacre started soon after.
So I know that 2020 has been a year of knowledge and like reckoning for a lot of white people. But I think that, Watchmen, that show on HBO, that came out.
I have watched it.
So that was I guess, a lot of people's introduction to the Tulsa Race Massacre.
Yes.
I first heard about it when my grandparents took my oldest cousin and I on a road trip to Allentown, which was the first incorporated Black city in California. Granted, after the trip, they forgot me and the bus left without me.
Naturally.
But because, you know, I had a little extra time with tour guides, they like were talking about the Tulsa Race Massacre. And so I think that excavating these burial grounds and finding these bodies and acknowledging the tragedy that this was will definitely be an important step in terms of recognizing American history and one of the many things that has gone terribly wrong and how Black people in America have suffered just for being Black. Like, these people specifically moved and segregated themselves for their own protection, and that still wasn't enough.
Yes. I think that when I was reading this, I also did some research. For the most part, this massacre, it's mandated in Oklahoma to teach, but it's not mandated everywhere else to teach. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is something, especially when it's called like one of bloodiest race massacres ever, that it should be in the textbooks, that we should be reading about it and learning about it within the classrooms. Watchmen, I did watch, and it took place in Oklahoma, and it did bring up the massacres, which I thought was good. Sadly, I don't think that show is going to have more seasons because I believe the main character got casted into something else. I thought that she did a very good job of it. But the crazy thing too with the whole massacre is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back in 1921, we're trying to kind of protect Dick Rowland, who was accused of doing something that he didn't do. And sadly, it was unsuccessful. And it wasn't until, so around 9 p.m., it was a lot of African Americans, mainly World War I veterans, that had come to the courthouse trying to guard Rowland. Mm. After the sheriff turned them away, and some of the white mob tried unsuccessfully to break into the National Guard Army nearby, they kind of seemed like most people, from what I've read, went home. But then rumors started going around about a possible lynching, and a group of around 75 armed Black men returned to the courthouse around 10 p.m., where they were met by about 1,500 white men who carried weapons. And it seems like that's kind of where like shots broke out. What really got me was over the next couple of hours of this like shooting and looting and burning was that even some of the deputized officers were giving weapons to people on the street. So white folk on the street.
I feel like we still see that now in terms of protests. How many instances have there been of people peacefully protesting, the police show up, and then that's when things escalate and get violent? Or if there's like two groups, if there's protesters and counter-protesters, the counter-protesters are often, like, there's video footage of the counter-protesters being protected by police behind, like, lines of protection and safety and, you know, being supplied with water and safety. That's, to me, telling me everything I need to know about where your alliance lies and where your allegiance is. You're not protecting and serving like your oath says. You have malintent and you are enacting that actively and passively.
Yeah, well, the whole idea of police officers really started with the patrolling and monitoring of African Americans.
Exactly.
So that's kind of like the roots of it all, really.
The only thing that's different is it doesn't say slave patrol anymore. It just says blah, blah, blah county. Whatever county there, or like blah, blah, blah city.
And I feel like just some of the other topics that we have talked about massacres or killings or bringing to the forefront and it making acknowledging this so that it's not repeated. Mm-hmm. Is that it wasn't really until 1996, which was like the 75th anniversary of this massacre, that a service was actually held. Because up until then, it seemed like Tulsa, Oklahoma was trying to like kind of bury this. They were getting rid of some newspaper articles that were kept for historical records. They were trying to really like bury this. So just like a lot of other states were trying to bury that they were, you know, lynching slaves. Or African Americans in general. And then it wasn't until 2012 where the state required that this massacre be taught in school.
Yeah.
Like, this is long overdue. 2012? 2012 when this happened in 1921. Mm-hmm. Pretty ridiculous. We're almost right now 100 years from it, and you're talking 8 years ago they just enacted the state to be teaching that statewide.
Yeah, and even with the fact that there are still surviving members of this, it just goes to show you that things aren't as distant as the media or like history books want you to believe. I think there's also been, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's also been a push to colorize photos from the civil rights era, because people, when they see photos in black and white, they view it as something that happened so long ago. Photography isn't technically new. There have been a lot of advances. People don't have to stand for hours to get a photo anymore. But I mean, my dad, he was born before the Civil Rights Act. I don't think my dad's old. I know I joke with him and tell him that he's old, but he's a fairly young man, and his birth certificate says Negro. Like, that is so close. Like, the racism is tangible. Like, it literally on his birth certificate, it has like his mom's name, it says Negro, and then it has teacher as her occupation, his dad's name Negro, and then I don't remember what they listed as my grandfather's occupation.
I'm all for, I remember being in high school and some of the World War videos have been changed to being in color, and that was pretty cool to see, which I'm definitely just, I think that's great, you know, to have, especially when the generations nowadays are just, they're used to color photos. But mm-hmm. I can remember my mom telling me back when she was younger, my mom's not old either. Her mom is 56 mm-hmm. and she can remember going down to the South when she was like a young teen and the pool still being segregated.
Yeah.
Like, that's not long ago. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, even being in Michigan, which is where my mom is from, it's a very racial state, I guess I can best put it as. And even back at like during my grandfather's time, being African American was just not ideal in the best words to put it, or being around. My mom had one African American in her high school growing up.
I can only imagine what that person dealt with on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, the trauma. Our next hot topic, voter suppression is ramping up with only 15 days left in the election. So voter suppression takes many forms, most of which are legal, including gerrymandering, inequitable and disproportionate numbers of poll stations, the Electoral College, and now in the light of the pandemic, some states have not provided their residents with the option of mail-in ballots. So they're requiring people to show up either for early in-person voting or on election day to vote in person. They're not opting for their residents to have any excuse to request a mail-in ballot. Unfortunately, stories of illegal practices by citizens have also become more prevalent in the last few weeks. The California Republican Party placed 50 deceptively marked ballot boxes in the Los Angeles, Fresno, and Orange counties, and they have not handed over the ballots to official government agencies, and they say they will continue the practice. Also in California, a ballot box in Baldwin Park was intentionally set on fire. So that's however many ballots just up in flames, and people aren't sure if their ballot was in there or when they're going to get another. A federal appeals court upheld the legality of one ballot drop-off location per Texas county, stating that Texans have many other means of casting their vote and should not rely on dropping off a ballot, which is really absurd because, as most people know, counties are not populated equitably. There might be one county that has 12,000 residents and then another county that has hundreds of thousands. And in-person voting has been going on in Virginia since September 18th, and a few voters have reported stories of being intimidated and questioned by people open carrying guns as they wait in line to cast their ballot.
Wow.
I will admit that after the 2016 election, I definitely was one of those people who was really disheartened and was just like, you know what, voting doesn't matter. But then 2018, like, midterm elections happened, and there were a few changes in terms of California congressional representatives that I guess gave me a little more hope. And also the fact that there are a lot of moving pieces trying to intimidate people or suppress votes. So to me, that just means that voting does matter.
Yeah, I always have thought voting matters, especially being an educated voter matters.
Exactly.
And the whole drop-off thing. If my, like, the best thing I can recommend is to track your ballot. I'm a California voter, and I know that California can track track it because I've been tracking my ballot. Mm-hmm. I would track your ballot, whether you drop it off at a ballot box or you go in person. I would just track it. Track it no matter what, to make sure that, you know, your vote has been received, to make sure it wasn't burned, that it wasn't whatever, you wherever it could possibly go, lost in the mail. Track it and make sure to hold, if you mail it in, the post office accountable, and just make sure it gets in. And if your county is too far to do a mail-in, then I guess wear your mask and bring your bag of lunch, if not dinner also, and go vote. It is a very important election, and we need our educated voters mm-hmm. to be voting.
I hear you when you're saying, like, we just got to hunker down and wait in line and cast your vote, like, by whatever means necessary. But that also just, it makes me think of people who have health conditions who cannot wait in line, disabled people who are not able to wait in line. Me as a med student, I do not get election day off. So it's just interesting. It's also interesting to me to hear of how other countries handle voting. Like, mm-hmm. election day is a national holiday. People don't have to work. It's an excuse day from work. Everybody, once they turn 18, they're automatically registered to vote. I think even in New Zealand, you're fined if you don't vote. It's like a $50 fine, mm-hmm. but it just really encourages people to vote.
2020 has honestly been a horrible year.
It's
just a horrible year.
Everybody's eyes peeling off scabs and band-aids.
Things that you would never think would happen are happening. Like, people have been voting by mail for years now. I've only voted by mail, and there's never been brought up voter suppression or fraud or any of this stuff that's been brought up this year. And it feels like it's never ending between just the battle between Democrats and Republicans and the fraudulent stuff and everything that everyone can possibly bring up against the other party. And I'm just like, how are we ever supposed to get anything done?
People just keep battling. That's also been my experience. It's always been really easy for me to vote, whether in person or do a mail-in ballot. I've never worried about my registration, but like, I'm learning more and more that that's not the reality for a lot of America. I think California is very different. And I also think that the places in California that we're from are also unique in the fact that it's encouraged that everybody vote. I know that in high school, one of my friends, like, there was a polling place in her garage. Like, they just had polling places in South Pasadena because they wanted all of those votes to count. 2020 has really just, like, cracked open everything. And it's just like, you can't avoid things that are shitty. Now you have to pay attention.
Yeah, definitely have to pay attention. One thing I did see, too, I did see a photo on social media mm-hmm. of all of the ballots, which has been a lot now, accumulation of ballots where people have not signed or the signature is not correct. Which, at this point, come on, people. Sign your ballot. Read everything thoroughly when you're signing your ballot mm-hmm. and make sure it matches your driver's license and get it in.
Yeah.
I don't understand why this is a problem. We're going to have thousands of people who voted, but it's not going to be able to be counted because they didn't sign their ballot or even sign it to match their driver's license.
Yeah. Or the people who are like writing in, oh my gosh, someone wrote in, was it Governor Chris Christie? He wrote in Ronald Reagan, sir. I thought you were in the hospital being treated for coronavirus. Get better before you try to play with somebody's election. Like, I don't have time for the shenanigans. Why are you voting for a dead man? That's not funny. It's not cute. It's also a reminder that I know a lot of people think of election day as a single day. This election is very unique in that every state basically has an early voting option. So it's not like 15 days until the election. We have 15 days left of the election.
Next hot topic is about a new Canadian bill that will hold Pornhub accountable for harming kids. So in our previous episodes, we've had conversations about Exodia's Cry, and in particular, Pornhub. Over the last 8 months, the Trafficking Hub campaign, led by Exodia's Cry, has grown into a global movement, garnering the support of over 2.1 million people and 300 organizations. The movement has grabbed the world's attention, exposing the crimes of Pornhub and how they have profited from exploiting underage girls. The campaign has been covered extensively by the media, being subject of over 300 different publications since it began. Among the chorus of supportive voices have been concerned citizens, celebrities, athletes, and lawmakers. Senators and parliamentary leaders like Senator Ben Sasse, Senator Rob Portman, Representative Jackie Speier, Canadian Independent Senator Dechen, Arnold Viersen, and seven other Canadian parliamentarians have all made public statements denouncing Pornhub and demanding that justice be served. It's these voices, the men and women who serve in positions of power in the U.S. and abroad, that are critical in bringing Pornhub to justice. Women's Day in Montreal has focused on the efforts on protecting children in Canada from being exposed to the explicit and criminal content which Pornhub and MindGeek are distributing. It's those efforts that led the introduction of Bill S-203 to the Canadian Parliament, a bipartisan effort to restrict children's access to pornographic websites like Pornhub. Bill S-203 is the first piece of related legislation to be proposed in the wake of the Trafficking Hub campaign. The bill would empower the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness to acquire pornographic websites to prevent anyone under the age of 18 from accessing them. The proposal declares that anyone making sexually explicit material available on the internet for commercial purposes has a responsibility to ensure that it is not accessed by young people. Ironically, the bill would require similar age verification technology that Pornhub senior staff stated would devastate their site traffic. As the bill language points out, technology has become so advanced that it can ascertain age without violating privacy. Think about that for a moment. Pornhub knows how to protect innocent children from explicit and demeaning content, yet chooses to profit. But if this bill passes in Canada, they will have no choice. The bill calls for fines of $250,000 for the first offense and $500,000 for a second to be levied against any corporation who violates the law. This bill also allows for prosecution of any director, officer, or agent of the corporation who directed or authorized any violation of the law, and it actually requires age verification. So any offending person or company couldn't just play off allegations by saying, we thought they were 18.
I definitely think that we thought they were 18 in whatever context it's used is some BS. Like, whether it's Pornhub who are saying, oh, we thought that half of our people were 18. No, you just said that that's most of your site traffic. You know how old these people are already.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why not do something to prevent those images, like you said, and like this bill is proposing to do, to prevent that from being viewed by minors? It seems really simple, and it just is another example of Pornhub once again choosing to be on the wrong side of history.
Yeah.
It's not that hard.
The whole idea to the allegation of we thought they were 18, that goes beyond just Pornhub. That goes with old men and men over the age of 18 who have sexual encounters with young girls and use that excuse as we thought they were 18. No, you didn't. You knew they weren't 18.
You knew. Because nobody over 18 is going to, even some people over 18 are going to give you like the time of the day. It, the people, at least that I have seen use that excuse, are always really pathetic people.
Yeah.
That anybody over the age of 18 will see through their BS and is not giving them the time of day. And that's why they're preying on younger people.
Yeah. But I do think that this proposal that is trying to declare that anyone making sexual explicit material available on the internet for commercial purpose has a responsibility to ensure that is not accessed by young people, which I think that is very powerful language, because young, both girls and boys who are looking at Pornhub, they see the sexual acts being performed and how the girls and the boys look on their men and women on there, and they kind of picture that's how it is. That's how sex is. That's how I should be portraying myself in sex. And that's not true. You don't need to have a storyline of how you were in class mm-hmm. or whatever mm-hmm. to leading to a sexual encounter. So I think it is just like kind of how social media gives an unreal approach or shows pictures of people that aren't realistic. I think Pornhub does the same thing. And I think regulating it until you're 18 is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does put more pressure on these companies to not neglect their sites and let them just run wild with even having girls and or boys being raped on their sites and profiting from it. It just seems like Pornhub just refusing to admit any fault or make any changes. And so I hope more bills are passed, not just in Canada, but in the US and other countries, because if passed, it would be a major step towards protecting young people from the dangers of online pornography. And it would just establish measures to hold companies like Pornhub accountable for their continued negligence.
And also a lot of these free online sites have the option for, I don't want to say social media, but like engagement. You can make an account, you can comment. And so I don't think, my personal belief is that there's not necessarily anything morally wrong with pornography, but like if you, like this bill is requesting, if you make it the responsibility of these corporations to make sure that their sites and their material isn't accessed by young people, I think that's just another gate to prevent people from falling in the trap of being solicited or being groomed online in the comment section of some video that's being glamorized.
Mm-hmm. All right. Our woman of the week is Dr. Antonia Novello, who was the first woman and the first Hispanic to become Surgeon General of the United States. She was born in Puerto Rico, and she suffered throughout her childhood from a medical condition that could only be corrected with surgery. Because her family could not afford the long trip to the surgical hospital, she spent part of every summer getting intermittent treatment in a local hospital. It was only after two surgeries at the age of 18 and 20 that the condition was finally corrected. By the time that she was a teenager, she had decided to be a doctor so that she could help other sick children. Dr. Novello earned her MD from the University of Puerto Rico, and her favorite aunt died while she was in medical school. And also when she was in medical school, she met and married Joseph Novello, a U.S. Navy doctor. She later completed her medical training in nephrology, the study of kidneys, at the University of Michigan, where she was first woman to be named intern of the year. Novello gained experience in pediatrics in Michigan until 1974, and after postgraduate work at Georgetown University and several years in private practice, she joined the U.S. Public Health Service Commission Corps in 1978, working with the National Institute of Arthritis, Metabolism, and Digestive Disorders at the National Institute of Health. She became Deputy Director of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, where she focused on pediatric AIDS. Through the prestige and authority of this office, the Surgeon General can more effectively exhort and educate the public on pervasive health issues. As Surgeon General, Novello focused on the health of young people, women, and minorities. She issued reports and spoke out on underage drinking, smoking, drug abuse, AIDS, especially among women and adolescents, childhood immunization and injury prevention, and improved health care for Hispanics and other minorities. After serving as Surgeon General, Dr. Novello was a special representative to United Nations Children's Fund from 1993 to 1996, where she expanded her efforts to address the health and nutritional needs of women, children, and adolescents to a global scale. From 1996 to 1996, she was visiting professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins School of Health and Hygiene, where she advised on health services for poor communities. To mark the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1998, Novello organized an unprecedented meeting between Surgeon General David Thatcher and seven others beside herself who had held the office. In 1999, Governor George Pataki nominated her to be Commissioner of Health for the state of New York, where she now heads one of the largest public health agencies in the country.
See, this is just another example of people committing to work and just doing it lifelong. I love it.
Getting it done.
She's 76 now, still working in public health. Honestly, I think my dream is to, after residency, work as a clinician for, I don't know, a decade or two? We'll see how burnt out that feels. Then work in public health and increasing health equity. specifically for underserved populations, whether that be urban racial minorities. It also includes rural populations that often don't have access to adequate health care.
Yeah, I feel like this is just an ongoing issue. Like, we still now and today have health disparities with minorities. Just our last podcast, we talked about Indigenous people, mm-hmm. specifically women. Mm-hmm. And the 1990s, when she was doing most of her work, and today we still have disparities. And I think it just really brings forefront again that we need to change this. This is just an ongoing issue where we have a lot of people making an effort to change it, but I think we as a nation need to address this issue. And I just love her concern for children and her being a sick child who grew up most of her life needing surgeries.
Yeah.
I hit home, and I just love that she was trying to help other children and minority groups.
Lastly, we have important events from this day in history. So on this day in 1972, the Clean Water Act was passed. It mandated the protection of any waters in the country with a significant nexus to navigable waters and established a framework for identifying, licensing, and enforcing standards on originators of point source pollution whose contamination stemmed from a single point like a factory or a sewage treatment plant. Though the Clean Water Act clearly had a positive impact, a high percentage of American waterways today still do not meet the water quality standards set forth by the law. A few examples that have been in media within the last few years include the fact that the city of Flint, Michigan is still without clean drinking water, and Indigenous people at Standing Rock were beaten and arrested for protesting to protect their water sources. So we have this law that could easily be enforced, but we still have more work to do in terms of making sure everybody has the right to clean water, which is the most basic right I think that people can have.
Yeah.
Like water, food, shelter. Those are the basic.
Those are the basic, and you definitely need water to live in general. But I think too, just, you know, even branching off of just in general having clean water to drink, but also just clean water in general, I still see thousands of photos from like 4Ocean and different other companies that do ocean cleanup. Mm-hmm. Especially now, the big complaint coming from them is PPE mm-hmm. that is still entering the waterways. That's just compounding the trash.
Yep.
And if we could just, you know, clean up our oceans, which is going to already take a long time because it's been years in the making of all that trash. But if we can get our acts together, clean our water, not only to drink, but to swim in, it could really change a lot. The fact that, you know, we're not even, we still have waters today, like Flint, Michigan, that people were getting sick off of. The last information that I read about Flint, Michigan was that some people there were getting reparations for that whole problem that ensued. But that took years.
It took years, and still, how can you really put a price on children like in the prime of their development when everything is so fragile and they need the best? They need clean water, they need food, and you've just exposed children to lead poisoning and other harmful elements in the water when it was preventable. To me, reparations is a start, but there's a lot more that the people of Flint deserve.
Yeah, exactly. We want to thank you for listening to ACT UP Podcast. If you like what you are hearing, please review us on whatever platform you listen to. If you have any recommendations or specific women that you would like to hear about, email us at actuppodcast1@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at actuppodcast.
The reputable sources that we acquired this week's information from are changingthefaceofmedicine.gov, NPR, ACLU, BBC News, and the History Channel. Thank you guys for listening, and stay safe.
Thank you.